Welcome to the latest Better Call Fargo edition of the Serious TV Drama Podcast with Scott and Dan. I'm Scott, and with me as always, the Mr. Wrench to my real mensch, it's Dan.
This is a true story, Scott.
I forgot to tell you before we started recording that I had made an...
called an audible?
An executive decision, if you will. Because I noticed that in that show, they didn't do it this week. They had This Is a True Story, and that was it. Did you notice that?
Yeah.
I was at a loss on that. So that's why I figured I would give us a break and not do it this week. But I realized, hey, I forgot to tell you that. Hey, so in a week that we've already gotten together a few days ago to talk about, you know, a fairly extraordinary hour of television, you know, the Leftovers series finale.
Yes.
I dare say we've got a trio of other shows to talk about that, depending on how we feel, either maintain their standard of continuing quality, or maybe raised it, or maybe not. I guess we'll find out when we talk about them.
Yeah.
So, without any further bizarre ado, let's start where we usually do, with Better Call Saul. Now, the latest episode from this week was titled Slip. It was written by Heather Marion, who also wrote last season's Click, and directed by Adam Bernstein, who was a well-respected director of many shows, especially several episodes of Breaking Bad and Fargo. And he's even a guy who has directed a lot of comedies like Scrubs and 30 Rock. Okay, so we open up this episode. We got a flashback with old Slip and Jimmy and Marco. I really enjoyed seeing Marco again. I was very sad because it made me remember. Oh, that's right. Didn't he die in an alleyway or something like that? It's a character I would wish that they would be able to bring back. But I mean, I guess they did find a way to bring him back. Duh. But definitely one of my favorite characters they've introduced in this Better Call Saul universe.
Yeah, nice to see him again.
And, you know, it was also kind of a nice little flashback moment because it gives us yet a little bit more information and a bit more of a perspective on the whole backstory that's, you know, the Jimmy and Chuck story as far as their dad in the store. And the more we hear Jimmy in this scene, the more you start seeing Chuck might have had a point. Again, not defending Chuck up to, you know, to the degree he went through his whole life, but Jimmy clearly didn't have the most respect for the way his dad ran his store or, in fact, ran his life. So it's, and yeah, that's an unfortunate thing, but it was kind of a nice little opener to the show that I wasn't expecting.
Yeah, I didn't think we'd see Marco again, so it was nice that they kind of were able to fit it in like this. And it was a kind of a fun scene too. I liked the way that they shot it and had it all, you know, kind of dark and weird lights going on various times.
Yeah, it was also, it's one of those fun things that, you know, the way to save money is using lighting a certain way so you don't have to like spend the most on a set and where you film something, whatever, which I sometimes suspect might be the case with Chuck's house, quite frankly. But I really like that too. I like the use and you know the use of light, the use of sound, you know the police sirens. That was kind of a nice little touch. It was a nice little opening there. Now in a way, I guess it really kind of links to, clearly links because it's the same character, so duh. But watching Jimmy throughout this episode, because we get that flashback where he's talking about his dad and the kind of person he was. And then you watch the episode and you see, well, Jimmy is always, or for a certain point in this episode, he's trying to do the right thing. specifically the stuff that goes on with the twins at the music store, the ABQ Intune music store or something. I mean, they had an agreement, and he's trying, I mean, of course, it doesn't really make a lot of sense because why would anyone need to film multiple commercials that for all that airtime? They're all going to air within the same short period of time. That doesn't. Nobody does that. But
No.
you'd run the same one multiple times. You wouldn't make seven different ones.
Yeah.
Because I mean, yeah, the twins—they're being kind of dickish about it, but it doesn't make any kind of fiscal sense. It doesn't sound like anything was ever put in writing. But it was funny because it means that Jimmy trusted them. It trusted he would honor their bargain, and I felt like the way Jimmy was thinking is just the kind of thing old Slippin' Jimmy would be snide about. He'd be like, "Are you kidding? You're just gonna take someone at their word that they would just, a handshake? No, that's bullshit."
Yeah, I
So.
suppose doing, doing elder law, he was able to do that kind of thing a little bit more, just because that, I suppose that generation's maybe a little bit less dickish, depending on who they voted for, and so on. But,
Was gonna say depending. You mean depending how they felt during the civil rights demonstrations of the 1960s? But well, let's make it
yeah.
modern day makes more sense actually. But then, what's funny is that then what he does in the store with the fall, it's kind of just funny that it's a literal reversion to Slipping Jimmy. He literally slipped,
Yeah. Yeah, I have a question for you about that. And I haven't went back and watched the scene, but would Jimmy knocking the drumstick onto the floor be on camera? Because didn't wasn't Kid Kubrick already filming at that point?
It would be, but they wouldn't know that.
Yeah.
So I think the whole thing was he thought they wouldn't have known that that had happened. So right. Yeah, I thought something like that too. Also, I kind of thought that a store like that would have cameras anyway, because pretty much all store. Although, what year is it supposed to be? I keep forgetting this is a lot further back than we realize. So.
Yeah, it's a little ways back, and a small business like that, they don't always have cameras.
Oh, maybe I'm just more used to the New York thing because every single business has a camera in it. I mean, it could be the shittiest bodega that sells nothing. They've got cameras, It could be the Salvation Army store has fucking cameras, and they're giving away stuff there. But what was I gonna say? Oh, but what's interesting about that because there he's kind of you could say he's kind of doing a Slippin' Jimmy thing. But what he does at the end of the episode with that drug dealer, about helping get him out of community service for the day, I think that's as close as we've gotten to like a real Saul Goodman moment on this series so far. That felt
Yeah.
really Saul Goodman-esque to me, just the whole
Yeah.
bit. So.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun just listening to him, spinning all that bullshit. And I mean, he just totally had that community service supervisor, whatever the heck you would call that dude.
Yeah, wait, I don't know what you call him.
He was all over that shit.
And I like how they did it in a way that which was acceptable, excuse me, acceptable for the audience because we already had established that that guy was an asshole, that he was kind of being kind of, he was being kind of a real dick to Jimmy before in the previous episode, or whatever. So it's kind of like, oh, okay, so you kind of root for him to do that there. It'll be interesting if and when there's a moment where he does something like this. And we don't feel that way, where we feel someone that he's getting the better of someone that we don't feel deserves to be treated a certain way. I mean, I don't know if the show will do that. That's kind of a risk also, because then it's kind of like the Walter White phenomenon, where the further you go, the more you have your character doing things which are actually unlikable. They haven't gone very far with that with the Jimmy McGill character as of yet.
Yeah,
Even.
they've done stuff that's made us feel a little bit uncomfortable, and watching Kim feel uncomfortable makes us a little bit more uncomfortable. But
Right.
they definitely haven't escalated it yet.
Right. Yeah, and we actually got another somewhat uncomfortable scene between Jimmy and Kim in this episode. Maybe not to the extreme that we felt in that previous episode with when they went out for the drink, but the scene when he's lying on his back with the guitar, that, for me, that felt kind of weird between them too. You know, I mean, it's,
yeah.
And it's, I think it's, and it feels like it's not simply about pride, though that's obviously playing a big part. And that's a familiar trope on the Vince Gilligan shows. But there's just something about it. There's something about the way he's speaking to her the whole time. And maybe it's just because of the awkward, the deliberately awkward staging of it. Because, you know, he's lying on the floor with the guitar. And I like that he's riffing, not that well, but he's riffing Smoke on the Water, which we'd heard in a previous episode, which he actually is linked to Marco, actually.
Yes.
So it's kind of, I like how that kind of comes together in a way. So you can almost imagine that he was think the flashback we had at the beginning of the episode might have actually been in Jimmy's thoughts recently. So, or
do
maybe.
Do you think that, oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
Do you think that Jimmy might have a little, resentment towards Kim for the situation he's in right now? Since even though it's not her fault and she didn't ask him to do anything, but I mean, he did do, you know, he did what he did that got him, you know, his suspension for her. So, you know how people can be in that kind of situation where they can end up blaming somebody for, you know, their part in their own bad decision making.
Oh, that's interesting. I hadn't really thought of it that way. I don't know. I'm going to say no only because I'm not getting the sense that he regrets what he did to Chuck at all. I mean, he doesn't, I don't think he's thrilled with the consequence of his decision, or I don't think he realized just how much of a pain in the ass it would be. He probably had, I mean, it looked to me like he just forgot about the commercial stuff and the money relating to that, and that's kind of wiped him out a bit more than he was expecting to. But I was thinking of it more, it's the resentment, it's almost like a form of jealousy. So it is connected to that, but it's more like she was an active participant in taking down Chuck, but he has to be suspended for a year because of the stuff he did before that. That's why, Jimmy. But she gets to continue practicing, and she's being viewed more and more as, you know, a more than not just a capable attorney, but a really fine attorney. And she's making money. She's able to cover her half and even offers to pay his half. So even with just the one client, she's doing extremely well. No one wants to be, you know, jealous or envious of someone that they're close to, you know, but it can happen. I mean, I know I felt it at times in my life. I'm sure other people do as well. We don't care to admit it out loud because it makes us sound like, you know, like we're douchebags. But it's kind of human quite often, I think.
Yeah, it's a very human thing to go through that kind of crap. It's, you know, it's just, you know, not necessarily all our fault all the way. The way that the world is set up and, you know, this country in particular is just, you know, you have certain expectations you're trying to meet for whatever reasons, you know, because capitalism has convinced you have to do these certain things. And, you know, it's easy to buy into that kind of crap because that's how we've been raised. So you know, we people make mistakes and we do dumb stuff like that and we're petty. And Jimmy is definitely not a flawless human being. So
nah.
I could easily go there.
Right. Well, it's excuse me. The unfortunate thing is I feel like we're watching a very slow unraveling of this relationship between them. And that doesn't mean that things can't be knit back together. And yes, I know what I just said. I did that on purpose. But I don't know, because it's also one of these things like we don't actually know how much longer the show is going to go on for. Last I checked, it actually hasn't been renewed yet. I'm sure it will be.
Yeah.
But it hasn't been, so it's kind of, so you don't know. I think we've all been expecting, oh, they can do definitely at least 5 or 6 seasons of this, and like, probably, but who knows? Maybe they'll only do 4. We don't know. Who knows?
Yeah.
Back to Kim, though, since we're talking about her. I did like that scene between her and Howard, the way that, even though we know how bothered she is by her participation and what they did to Chuck overall from previous episodes, all along, quite frankly. But I love that matter-of-fact way she defends herself about what they did to Chuck. And she really turns the tables on him, where she kind of points out of how he's ignored and even, I guess, exploited to some extent Chuck's illness himself all this time. So I really, that was an unexpected confrontation that I really enjoyed in the episode.
Yeah, that was another nice thing I wasn't expecting, and then just something that I really hadn't given a ton of thought to. I mean, Howard isn't the worst person in the world, but he definitely has been, not the best for his clients, I suppose. Just keeping Chuck stuff, as hidden as possible.
Right. Well, it's one of those things where on one hand, you can excuse it because they're trying to press on, and they've tried to minimize Chuck's participation in the law firm overall, but at the same point, you know that you're dealing with a very sick man, and you're doing it in a way where it's more coddling than doing anything that might actually be better for him in the long run, because I think most people have always assumed that his situation was one that was mental, because people are like, this, how many people does this affect in the world? 50? 100? That's some ridiculous thing. I don't know what it was. But I really like that scene, too. But overall, one of the things, I mean, there's still lots more to talk about, but one of the things I really liked about this episode was there was a nice balance of storylines for, like, everyone in this episode. It almost felt more like an ensemble episode to me, because everyone had significant scenes on their own, if I recall,
Yeah, it definitely felt like they're covering more ground this week, and I'd say Twin Peaks kind of did the same thing, but not quite in as a not quite as linear a fashion. So.
Oh yeah, we'll get to that. My tone might change during that conversation, but I'm still going to be in positive land with this one. So Chuck, and we got to see is it Ruiz? Is that her name? I didn't write down her name. The one that Clea DuVall plays. I think it's Dr. Ruiz. We got to see her again, and we see that Chuck is actually coming to grips with the idea that his condition is in fact mental. So it's interesting that Chuck. This actually might end up having an overall positive impact or effect on Chuck, considering he considers what happened to be like the worst thing that's ever happened to him. As he puts it, or something. I don't remember. He puts it some way like that. Although you think maybe his wife leaving him would be the worst thing, but whatever. But I kind of like that, and then seeing him test himself in a supermarket and stuff like that. So that's kind of fun to see.
I kind of hope Chuck gets better, and I'm guessing that it'll be complicated whatever happens, but. I'm not rooting against him anyway.
Yeah, I mean, it'll be a sad when he burns to a crisp, but yeah. what else? Oh, well, then we had that extended stuff with Nacho preparing the pills and then practicing slipping them into Hector's jacket. I love the focus on the detail there and how something that seems so simple but could go so horribly wrong. So I was enjoying that whole thing, and I love giving that character a bit more of a focus as well, because he's a good actor, and he's one of those good bad guy kind of characters, because he's not really a good guy, but he's not really a bad guy. He's kind of somewhere in between. So I know, other than the flashback, you haven't gotten an opportunity to make much comment about how things like looked really cool. I want to mention what I thought was one of the coolest shots I've ever seen on this show, and see if you agree with me. Quite often, they have a lot of fun, like really going to town when they shoot scenes with Mike. Either be the Grand Vistas or the noir kind of thing or whatever. That overhead shot of him when he was searching in the desert for what turned out to be the body of the Good Samaritan. When they did the things with the multiple mics, the kind of like the time lapse thing, that was awesome. That was to me one of the best shots I've ever seen on the show. I mean, I It's stuck in my head. I've got little mics crawling around the side of my head right now, just thinking about it.
Yeah, the way that they set up that crane shot was really sweet, and you know, there'd be, I think it'd be more of like an editing thing than a time lapse thing, because you know, a time lapse thing wouldn't have, it wouldn't have multiple mics per se. Time lapse is more of like you're just taking a picture in the same shot over. Yeah, but
I misspoke.
Yeah, but yeah, no, but it's pretty cool. You know, the way they did that, it's just a lot of fun. I mean, just in every way.
Now, do you think he was purely trying to uncover that body just to like give that family closure? Because you know, the body had never been found, so they don't know what didn't know what happened to their loved one. Or do you think there could conceivably be any blowback on the Salamancas? I mean, I don't know if they would have left any evidence that would have done that, so I don't know about that. So,
I could see him maybe planting evidence on the body, and then it's like, you know, he's doing his part to like help Nacho out, like on his own end without Nacho really knowing. Just like, you know, maybe he's trying to do something that's going to piss off Hector and, you know, hasten that.
But I feel they would have shown something then if he did that, because they showed him finding it, and then the next thing you know, he's making a phone call. So, I'm choosing to believe it's just the former, because there's something more noble about that, and I still like to think that Mike has a certain amount of nobility to him. Speaking of which, it never occurred to me that he would need to have that money laundered, but I guess it does kind of make sense that he's got $200,000. I wish I had $200,000. So I love that they found a way to get to, so we did get Fring in this episode, which I didn't know because I saw it in the credits, but whatever. So I guess what we might have just seen was, with that handshake, I like to think it was like the Casablanca moment, the start of a beautiful friendship or something there.
Huh. Nice. Sweet.
So overall, I mean, again, it's interesting because this is a series that it felt like it hit its high point with the hearing with Chuck and Jimmy, whatever. So it's makes me more curious about how they're going to end the season, because I already feel like they've already like I don't know if there's anything in the Jimmy storyline right now that feels like it's building up to something that would be like a big season finale thing. I mean,
it seems like the Hector and Nacho and Mike stuff is definitely
You
know, if anything crazy is going to happen, it's going to be that. Not that there won't be some, you know, simmering tension and probably some.
Is your phone or microphone getting muffled by accident there?
No, no, it's probably just a weird Skype connection.
Okay. Although, if Chuck does burn up in a fire, that could be the big thing for the Jimmy Sterling. So is that
right? Yeah,
we can still hope. I'm just kidding. All right, but I get the feeling we both pretty much kind of sort of really liked that episode. I know I did. I there might have been some negativity about it online. I give up on those people at this point. I guess there are a few people out there who feel the show doesn't move fast enough for them and there's not enough going on or whatever. And again, it reminds me of the way people would complain about shows like Mad Men or things like that, you know. Then there's other shows. That's just the first one that comes to mind. And I just think personally, like, I think if you don't have the patience for shows like this, then don't watch them. Because you can
Bingo.
Say, you know, I'm sorry. And it's not just, I mean, people have said that there are seasons you can say that about The Americans. There are seasons you can say that about The Sopranos. A lot of The Wire. You can say that about any number of shows. They're not action shows. I don't know what you people want. Anyway, I'm sure it's not anyone who's listening to our podcast, but you know what I mean.
Yeah. Well, I got to say that the scene with Nacho making the first switch was pretty fucking amazing.
Mm-hmm. I love the idea that he had to screw with the air conditioning to make sure Hector would take off the jacket. I just love how he planned. That was like some Mike kind of planning. I don't know if he, as I know they cut away in that previous episode when he was talking to Mike. I wonder if Mike gave him any advice on this plan. That felt like a very Mike idea. But yeah, that was pretty fantastic.
Yeah, it was super tense, and I'm guessing that since we know like what he has to do, like just to make another switch in like a far more like, you know, potentially chaotic situation, that's just going to be insane.
Yeah,
like him having to like switch, like, you know, switch the pills back with the other pills and then put the other bottle back. I mean, he can't just have like another bottle and freaking, you know, switch the bottles. I mean, he has to go through an extra step, and it's going to be fucking awful, and it's going to be amazing.
Absolutely. I'm looking forward to it greatly. Okay, so I guess now it's time to head on over to Fargo. Now, the latest episode of Fargo was titled Who Rules the Land of Denial? It was written by Noah Hawley and Monica Bletsky. Talked about both of them before. And directed by Mike Barker, who I think directed the last one, or the one before that. Doesn't matter, I'm not going to talk about him either, because we talked about him before too. Hey, let's just dive into the first half of this episode. Because I think... I mean, nothing against the second half of the episode, but it's the first half that really deserves the bulk of our conversation, I'm feeling. Like, Act 1, you got the bus accident and then that subsequent pursuit through the woods. So, tell me how much you enjoyed this.
I thought it was really, really good. They made so many awesome choices there that helped make it, you know, even better than what we were seeing. Like the fact that you don't hear anything while Mr. Wrench is like the point of view character, because like of course you're not going to hear anything. And then when Nikki wakes up, then there's audio again, and just like little touches like that just helps, like, you know, it really helps like enhance like what's already like, you know, cool and awesome and messed up in the first place. I mean, that was just, you know, brutal, really well shot. Like, just a crazy awesomeness. And then, like, you know, a nice long first act with just, you know, they gave it plenty of time to do its thing. It did its thing nicely.
Yeah, what I loved about the entire sequence and the entire act, I guess, is that you could never be sure what was really going to end up happening. I mean, the only thing I knew for sure was, I said from the get-go when I was watching the scene, like, to myself, like, well, I know DJ Qualls is gonna die, because they just added him into the mix. He feels like he's gonna die. But I don't know if the other two get away or not. I don't know if Mr. Wrench is gonna live or not. I didn't know. I'm just like, the show can kill people, or someone else could pop up, whatever. So it was a really nice use of tension, a really nice use of the look, the sound, the lighting. I mean, it was very dark, but it's at night, so it should be dark. I love the whole intercutting back and forth with showing them creating the situation that was going to make the bus crash in the first place. Then the real, even though I guess we did sort of realize it when we watched the end of the previous episode, but I got a better sense of the true brutality of them, the way they were like killing the correctional officers or police, whatever you call the people who were on the bus, which is really, really brutal. But yeah, it, and you know what? It also makes what at first seemed like a kind of an odd piece of, I don't know if stunt casting is the right phrase, but having Mr. Wrench show up and when we saw him in the previous episode, I was like, oh, that's kind of strange. But now you realize, oh, you had a plan. Because there's no way she does any of this without someone like that being with her.
No.
So that was, I really enjoyed that. Also, it's kind of a fun thing because there's so many things that running through the woods of the forest felt evocative of. For a lot of major classic TV fans, many people might be thinking of The Sopranos. One of the most famous episodes of The Sopranos is an episode called Pine Barrens, where you have a couple characters wandering around the woods, and there is someone who may either they're pursuing or they think could be pursuing. No, they're pursuing. That's right. So it reminded me of that. And of course, Fargo, season two, like when Bear takes Simone out into the woods, or the big shootout, which takes place partially in the woods as well. So I'm guessing it's the same woods. I don't know. You'd actually know better than I would, but
it definitely seemed like, you know, the kind of geography that you'd see up in central northern Minnesota and at winter. So it was cool. They just, you know, they really used the setting in a very nice way, and I'd say in a manner that they really haven't utilized much this season, to the show's detriment.
Yeah.
At this point, so it's good that they finally got around to like actually utilizing some of that beautiful snow and
right.
creepy woods.
I mean, I'll say as far as the first act is concerned, I really enjoyed. I enjoyed all of it. I mean, the only thing I had any minor issue with, and this comes up with Fargo anyway, but usually it's not only not a problem; it's usually something I appreciate or even embrace. And there were things that happened later in the episode that I would embrace in this manner. But in this act, there was one thing I was like, kind of, that's a bit too on the nose, just like the original movie kind of moment for me. When that car drives by the bus and sees them, and, and then they end up, obviously, Mimo tracks, goes after them and kills them. I mean, that's right out of Fargo, the movie. I mean, it's almost the exact same thing, where a car driving by, the goofy looking while they've seen a horrible crime being committed, and then someone gets in a car and takes off after them, runs them off the road and executes them. So it's the same thing. So I know I've been more than okay with that, or more so for any number of things, but this just felt too, it was too much the same, if that makes any sense for me. It was just like, eh.
Yeah, it kind of felt like the director was maybe doing a little bit, I don't know what the word I'm looking for is, but, maybe just, using like stuff that like he thought was cool from like, Coen Brothers shit, and just like, hey, I have an excuse to do the exact same thing now, I'm going to do it. And I don't know if that's necessarily a great thing.
Yeah, for this, I'm going to say it wasn't. It felt to me like it was just they needed an excuse to not have Mimo go in the woods with them, so there would be only two of them instead of three. Because otherwise, he's with them, and maybe they don't get away as a result. But I don't know. Anyway, so that was Act One. However, as awesome and interest or whatever, as far as, technically and tension filled, whatever you want to call it, Act One was, what'd you think of Act Two? Which, I guess we can call it the bowling alley act, or, if you want.
Yeah. Anytime you let Ray Wise get on screen and do something interesting, I'm usually a happy camper. So I was a happy camper.
I mean, I'll tell you right now that my first clue that this was going to be something strange and not purely some sort of homage to, say, like the Big Lebowski, because, oh, look at the bowling alley, is just the fact that where they were, because it appeared that they've been going for this a very long stretch of, where there was like pretty much no trace of civilization anywhere. And then after all this, they come upon a bowling alley? It just seems so bizarrely random, like the last thing that should be so way off, away from everything. It's not like a gas station or a diner or something. It's a bowling alley that seems to be remote and by itself or something. Which,
yeah, that is kind of a thing that happens in the Northwoods for whatever reason. Bowling is still relatively popular up here, so there are a fair amount of them scattered, several miles from towns. I mean, I can think of like four or five just like offhand that are like not really super close to anything.
Well, and that may very well be true, but I like to think, or I don't know, forget the like to. I think that they're doing it this way deliberately. Because, well, what happens in the scene? You know, I think that this whole little scene almost takes place outside of, it almost takes place outside of reality, quite frankly, or the real world. This is Fargo almost, you know, put once again, like putting a toe into something very different. You know, it was almost Twin Peaksian to a certain degree. Ray Wise, that we already had seen him earlier in the season in that LA episode. So how he ends up being in LA meeting Burgle and then this remote bowling alley here only adds to the, okay, that I think that's not supposed to make sense. I think there's something more to him, which as the scene unfolds, clearly there's something more to him. He's not just some guy. There's something downright supernatural going on here.
Black Lodge related, I would guess.
Yes, a little bit. Although although positive, because his name, I think he says his name is Paul Moraine, and doing a little bit of interwebbing about that, I looked it up. It's actually one of the names or aliases, if you prefer to use a phrase like aliases, for the legendary Wandering Jew. Now, anyone out there who's not familiar with the story of the Wandering Jew, to describe it somewhat briefly, that was a guy who was doomed to wander until the second coming of Christ because he had actually taunted Jesus as he passed him, you know, with the cross, you know, saying, "Go on quicker." And Jesus is said to have replied, "I go, but thou shalt wait till I return." So then if you explore it more, then you have all these, you know, stories and tales of the Wandering Jew and the things he did and whatever. It's funny because his story seems to start out like, oh, he sounds like kind of a dumb schmuck. And then he's actually, there's something almost more legendary, almost heroic about him. It's very strange. Strange story. Yeah. But, you know, Jews, what are you going to do? They seem to be talking about Jews a lot on the season of Fargo. It's a very strange season in that sense. But, and just to continue my Jewish stream of consciousness here, for anyone who didn't get it, there's a point when he's talking to Nikki and he refers to the irony of it all. This is when he's offering her the getaway car. He's referring to the Jewish perspective once again because, you know, again, Wandering Jew. And the whole story tells us about, you know, famous sort of Jews, whatever. Because as some might know, many might know actually, following World War II, Jews around the world, they weren't too keen on driving German cars, especially Volkswagen, which, and anyone out there can correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I think Volkswagen actually manufactured many of the vehicles that were used by the Third Reich during World War II. Pretty sure about that. Apologies if I'm wrong to Volkswagen.
Yeah, well, Hitler was directly responsible for the formation of the company.
See, I'm glad you're podcasting. See, you know more about that than I do.
Yeah, he wanted every German to have a vehicle, so Volkswagen is like, you know, the people's, like, you know, wagon, I guess. But that's a German word for a folk.
Well, I'm glad I have my Hitler loving butt. No, I'm just kidding. But that whole, everything about that scene between, we get, I keep wanting to call him Ray because he's Ray Wise, but then that gets confusing because of the character Ray, who gets talked about in the scene. It's an interesting thing when you have a character telling a story to another character who clearly doesn't know what the hell is going on, but is patient enough to still go along with it. So kind of want to give Nikki a lot of credit in that scene. And I love the job the actress is doing. She's definitely become a really great character on the show. But the stuff with the kitten was kind of out of left field. But I'll admit that I went all.
Yeah, we don't see a lot of cats on these TV shows that we watch. So I'm just like, oh, sweet. I'm a cat guy. And it was a cute kitten. Ray the cat.
Right, Ray the cat. That... Because I was like, no one names a cat Ray randomly. That's crazy. So they get away. Then Yuria shows up. Now, the implication is that they kill Yuri here. Is that how you took what you took it to mean? That's kind of how I took it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure exactly, like, you know, who killed him or how. You know, it just kind of felt like some Twilight Zone-esque stuff to me. But as to whether or not, you know, I'm guessing he probably didn't survive, or if he did, he's going to be all kinds of, like, you know, just mentally done for. But well, it didn't seem like he's, you know, he's going to be in good shape after that.
Well, they make a reference later on in the episode after the, time jump, in the episode. Where he's because they refer to what happened to the Russian, and I think they're talking about him as far as what they anticipate happening to Sai. So I felt like they kind of imply that he's dead. Not to mention that when he's talking to him, when the Ray Wise character is talking to him, it seems like he's talking to them with, it's almost like he's, if you're any classic DC comic fans, will know who I'm talking about. It's kind of like he's talking like he's the Spectre, because he's talking about, you know, kind of like, it's kind of like a revenge, vengeance for the wrongs he has done, and now he has to pay for his thing, you know, what he did, whatever. And before they cut away, when they all of a sudden have that moment of you see the people from way back when, in black and white even, you know, like all standing there, and I went, that's why I think, I don't think you show that moment and you don't kill that character. Unless he's just in a paralyzed catatonic state or something like that, if that's what you mean, like just like he's a gibbering idiot, which I could see them doing that as well.
Yeah, for, you know, size, you know, basically in a catatonic, or not catatonic, but he's in a coma, so it's something that maybe they would do, but probably not. I mean, this is definitely like a, you know, once this happens in the Twilight Zone, you're pretty much done for. So Yuri's probably pretty much done for.
If that is the case, I do hope they're in adjoining rooms, because that would be awesome.
Definitely could set it. Could set up something interesting if that was true.
Right. Oh, it'd be awesome if they did. Speaking of Sai, wouldn't he know by now not to take anything offered in a cup or a mug from Vargas? I mean, after the.
Well, one would assume so. After his questionable liquid experience.
Yes, really. Because I mean, that's almost what I didn't. I'm not. I mean, I kind of enjoyed the scene anyway because of this the insanity of it and like all the food and everything. It's like, well, we all know where that food's going to end up, you know, in the next half hour anyway. It's going to be puked up. But I'm watching. It's like, no, it's obvious what he's doing. What? I'm just waiting for. Okay, is he going to drive off the road? Or of course, it has to be in the most goofy and gross way possible. God, so much vomiting on TV the last few weeks. It's unfortunate, but hopefully maybe he awakens from his coma in the following episode, because I hate for the show not to have Sai Feltz playing a part in it, because definitely one of our favorite characters on the show, and been one of the reasons we've stuck with this season, I would say.
Yeah, I'm assuming we'll see more of him doing something, or else I just would have killed him there.
So
I could be wrong.
Right, so... But with the Sai story, that gave them this little opportunity to have a mini time jump here. I mean, they basically jumped about 3 months. They jumped from, you know, Christmas time to the middle of March. It's weird. I feel like it's almost a comment on the series that it doesn't seem like that much has happened over the course of 3 months beyond, you know, Gloria being officially demoted and Emmett slowly being driven nuts by who I guess I'm assuming it's Nikki. I guess we just haven't seen it yet, but it doesn't look like that much has changed. It kind of makes me think about the series overall this season, being like, maybe it's almost a comment on it, so to speak. The one kind of odd thing, I don't know if it's odd or interesting, but I'll say it anyway, that I noticed was at Stussy headquarters, the whole bit with where there were reproductions in different frames or close-ups or whatever of the stamp that are all over Emmett's office, and as well as outside the office, as we see when he looks outside, whatever. This is the first time I've noticed this, and if that was the image that was on the stamp all along, I just wasn't able to see it in previous episodes.
Yeah.
If I'm not mistaken, what we're seeing on the stamp, it's an illustration that's actually depicting the myth of Sisyphus, which was a title of an episode from season 2 and a story that's been talked about and referenced in Fargo. You know, about the one about the guy who keeps pushing the boulder up and he keeps rolling back down on him and so on and so forth. So I didn't realize that the stamp itself is actually a callback to previous Fargo seasons.
So, interesting.
Was there anything else about the episode specifically that kind of caught your eye or fancy or ire or anything else before we move on any further?
No, the show has definitely turned around in the back half of the season, and I'm interested to see what they're going to do here. So, good job, Fargo. Yeah, keep up the good work.
Yeah, I mean, it. The unfortunate thing is just that the characters at the core of it were not the ones that we cared the most about or found the most compelling, unlike previous seasons. So that's always going to be a weakness of the season, and the general redundancy that we felt as well, I think. Oh, by the way, I forgot to mention this. I didn't realize when they're at the bowling alley, because I was thinking, oh, they're doing a Big Lebowski. Then I realized, wait a minute, kind of the whole plot of this show as far as the actual crime kind of reminds me of the Big Lebowski, because it's all about someone being mistaken for someone else and, you know, murders happening all based on someone having the same last name. And I was like, oh, because that's the story of the Big Lebowski. Then you got it happening here with Stussy, so. Hadn't occurred to me until last night when I saw the bowling alley, so but I mentioned it now. Okay, so let us move on to our final show of the evening, which would, of course, be Twin Peaks. It's only been a few days since I've watched part 5. It feels like it's been several weeks, so I might need to rely on you and your memory of this episode more than what I have going on in my brain, Dan. So,
yep.
I've definitely got some opinions about this episode, but okay. I haven't really gotten to hear any of yours on it. I don't think we've really talked about it online at all, so... never mind the listeners, I'm just curious what you thought of this. I'm just curious how much of a critical eye you gave to it or not, or how much you enjoyed, or maybe you just purely enjoyed it. So, what do you think of this episode?
Okay, I wasn't a fan of the Jacoby, like, acting like Alex Jones type shit. I thought it was a little bit campy and, like, not necessarily the good Twin Peaks campy way. And just a bit, well, it was kind of like they were making, like, a kind of like a Saul Goodman advertisement, but like not charming at all. But other than that, I really don't have any complaints about the episode. I liked the various characters that we got to see again, sometimes without context, sometimes without really any you know, particular rhyme or reason. But I mean, David Lynch stuff tends to be in that manner, and it never really bothers me. I liked what I saw. It was kind of, I regretted a little bit that there was only one episode this week instead of two, but, I think having one instead of two makes it a little bit easier to, like, you know, put up with Dougie just being such a complete fuckhead. You know, it's not annoying me, but I could see how if there was a couple, you know, a couple hours straight of that, you know, people could be, you know, get a little bit weary of it. You know, if, you know, they can be weary about it already if they want, but maybe I myself would have been, you know, just like, okay, you know, get to it. But I think they've shown enough with, you know, I think we might have talked about this on the Leftovers podcast or before it or whatever, but, you know, the fact that Jade, the prostitute, dropping the Great Northern motel key into the post office box, you know, it definitely indicates that that storyline will, you know, start to resolve itself at some point, and it probably won't take forever to get to that point. So, you know, as long as they keep doing, you know, goofy stuff with Dougie just being, I mean, Dougie must have just been like the biggest, just complete fool in the real world, because people aren't treating him like, you know, that much. To, you know, I mean, just people must be used to him, or just, you know, this show is weird and people, you know, put up with weird people. But you know, I enjoyed it in between the weird, you know, coffee shenanigans and all that other stuff.
It disturbs me that I have to rely on the U.S. Postal Service to help the show move, get to a point faster, because that doesn't give me a lot of confidence that those keys are going to get to the Great Northern Hotel anytime soon. All right. I like this part the least of all five parts so far. Maybe because, you know, maybe also because, unlike the first four, there wasn't much of any foray into the weird and bizarre in this episode. That one part I really liked.
But when Cooper's like, you know, hacking Cooper. Whatever, yeah.
And when he looks in the mirror and you see like kind of like the little traces of Bob and stuff.
Ooh,
kind
of, that was sweet.
Especially since I believe that person's actually dead.
Yeah, Frank Zilva's been done for like ever.
Right. But putting that aside for now, you know, just getting to what's grinding me now. Look, I agree that some of it is amusing, and I think Kyle MacLachlan is, you know, doing a little, really great work. But I've reached my saturation point on the Dougie stuff right now, because I understand this is the strange, it's beyond surreal or unreal world of Twin Peaks, and, you know, people act and do all sorts of odd things. Generally, it was always within the town of Twin Peaks. I can't quite believe the way everyone acts and reacts to him, because some of these people should be thinking he's either totally lost his mind or had a stroke or something, especially his wife. That's the thing. I know this show is not reality in any way, shape, or form. So it's not. And so usually it's not about believing stuff, because there's all sorts of wacky, weird shit. That's what it's known for. But this, I'm not believing. It's bothering me. I'm enjoying his reaction to drinking the coffee and him saying. But it's also what's frustrating is because, you know, he says the coffee, and then he says words like agent and case files, but nothing changes. So I've kind of lost hope that his memory of who he actually is just going to come to him. Unless it's going to get triggered by someone giving him a slice of cherry pie to go with his coffee or something. So I think at this rate, it's going to have to be something or someone, I don't know, magical to do this job. It might be somehow Black Lodge connected, I guess. And so, which worries me, because I'm like, I don't know when this is going to happen. I don't know how much, because I don't know how much more the show can go on like that, because he's just, you have Kyle MacLachlan playing essentially two characters now, the blank Cooper / Dougie character and evil Cooper, who's, well, he's not, but the thing is, neither one of them are really Cooper to me, you know, they're not Cooper, they're just not. So I kind of, one of the things I, one of my very favorite things about Twin Peaks was Agent Dale Cooper. I really want to see Agent Dale Cooper again. So I'm hoping to get to that sooner than later, and then we can see what the hell else they're going to do with the show. Because right now, it's, you had that stuff going on, and I couldn't even tell you what else is going on. Or like, not in the surreal, you know, wacky way of previous episodes, which I adored, just like, so, because there are certain scenes that just didn't really do anything, and they felt like they were there maybe to like to make a joke, and the thing with David Lynch, you know, because he has his sense of humor, but sometimes he's not all that funny. like the thing you were talking about, like the Jacoby scene. Hey, I know there are people out there who love that scene. I didn't hate it myself. I think my problem with it was it went on, a common refrain for me, it went on a bit too long when they kept cutting, like, oh, look, there's a lady with the, is it Norma?
Yeah. Nadine.
Oh, Nadine. Well,
yeah. Right. And there was like three or four like Nadine reaction shots during that. So I'm like, you know, I don't think you need quite that many. So yeah, I'm not defending that scene because it was my least favorite part of the episode. So
But sometimes there's things that Lynch does, and I know he's doing this deliberately. So he's far from an amateur. You know, he's an auteur, quite frankly.
Oh yeah, everything he does is deliberate for whatever reason.
But sometimes it's one of those decisions where it either works or it doesn't, or you really enjoy it, or you're looking at like, well, like he'll deliberately put something together, and both the way it's shot and as well as cut together to simulate it could might as well be like something from Ed Wood. Or something you've watched on Mystery Science, and that's the way he did that with the Jacoby scene. It reminded me of a lot of like old, you know, movies, like really bad movies from the 50s, where you'd have a character talking, like he's talking to the screen, whatever, and they keep having these awkward cuts to people listening and reacting at home, and it's always like the same couple people over and over. You probably, if you've seen those kind of, you know what I'm talking about. There's any number of movies like that, and that's the way this looked. Especially hurt the way she hit the look on her face, and that was, so in a weird way, I kind of love hated that whole sequence, I guess. But I really, for me in the episode, the only thing that really stood out to me was probably Evil Cooper in prison, like what we were talking about, him. I mean, I don't understand. I might not understand what he was saying, you know. But you know, perhaps I don't know if it's probably like, I should call Mr. Strawberry. Perhaps not. I love that somehow ever since he's been imprisoned, his manner of speech has slowed down, like he's running on a low battery or something like that. Oh, did you? I didn't catch this myself. But maybe you've seen it posted online. It was like a little item. Did you see the thing about the episode when Evil Cooper or Dark Cooper or whatever we want to call him is meeting with Gordon and Albert and all of them? That one of the first things he says is actually they use the backwards forwards recording style for one of the words. Did you pick up?
No, I didn't see that or notice that.
I'll send you that. There's a whole thing about it. When he says I'm very, very pleased to see you or something like that. The first very, I know it's just one word, which is what makes it hysterical. The first very was actually recorded backwards and then played forwards again in the scene. And even when you watch it, like the subtitles, it does it. It actually looks like it's backwards. I'll send you the link when we finish recording. I'll send you. You can check it out. It's really funny. And apparently there's obviously we don't do super deep analysis because, you know, I'm not that smart and you don't have the time. But apparently there was like a million and one different callbacks and references just in that scene alone from a couple weeks ago or a week ago, whatever, referencing other moments between Cooper, earlier Cooper moments and stuff, which I didn't realize. Good on that.
So I can see, you know, your criticisms. I think they're valid. I have, like I said, the stuff doesn't really bother me that much. The way people interact with Dougie is definitely interesting, but and there's only one scene where we saw like actual Dougie instead of like Cooper Dougie, and in that scene where he's like, you know, hanging out with the prostitute, he definitely doesn't seem to be like, you know, that much of a you know, smooth winner, or particularly like, you know, like alive at all. So I just, you know, assume that anybody around Dougie is used to him being just kind of like a complete, you know, not this much of a tool, but enough of a tool where it's, you know, the way people are acting is definitely strange, but, you know, then no more so than like characters, you know. Right.
But the whole, like, even having, I mean, if he's having this issue with peeing, I mean, he's got to have to do number two at some point. How's Dougie gonna handle that? I'm not sure. Not to mention everything else. I mean, it's one of those things. Like, there were certainly other things that were memorable in the episode, but I don't know if that's good or bad. Like the fact that these you have both the guys who are hunting Dougie, and then you have these idiot car thieves both pulling up and checking out the car the same way, and like different kind of muscle cars. And then the whole thing where it just explodes,
an explosion like a really like oddly edited fashion with like a really weird special effect.
Yes,
it was, you know, it was like a, I don't know, like a stop motion, like I don't know what the hell they were doing. You know, it's just a goofy, weird, you know, weird thing. You know, it's Twin Peaks. There's weird stuff.
Yeah.
Lynch is, I don't know if he's having a good time, but he's definitely doing his thing the way he wants to do it. And you know, hopefully, you know, the show will you know, come together a little bit more, and some of this you know, random stuff that's happening will seem a little bit less random, rather than just like, you know, weird and not like fun weird, you know, which is one of the bigger criticisms about season two of Twin Peaks is like they, you know, started to do stuff that was just weird but didn't really have any like, you know, heart or mind behind it, so it just ended up being weird for weird's sake, and
yeah,
that ended up turning off a fair amount of people. So hopefully that isn't the stuff that you're going to be doing, you know, they're going to be doing here. I'm guessing Lynch and Frost will be able to pull off something better than the you know, whoever was kind of keeping it together after ABC pissed him off in season two. But we will see. With 13 episodes left, you know, I think they have a little time to do, you know, to, you know, tell, to have their jokes, you know, go a little long. But it definitely, you know, by the midpoint of the season, they really need to have, like, you know, we need to kind of have some idea what's going on, and like, you know, maybe not necessarily an end game, but at least feel like an end game is going to happen. Because as of right now, I mean, you know, they're,
right,
you know, it's all been, you know, basically set up.
Yeah, we still need to get a bit more with what's going on in South Dakota, with, you know, with the murders and stuff there. We got like a teensy bit about it, but we had such a teensy bit I've actually forgotten what it was. And then some of the stuff, I mean, yes, it was nice to see, you know, the gals at the diner and everything, but that whole thing with the daughter and like, oh, like like mother, like daughter, she's also got a shitty boyfriend who's kind of an asshole and blah, blah, blah. Maybe she'll be the next... I read somewhere like, oh, they're setting her up to be the next Laura Palmer. Like, really, we spent 2 minutes with her and you're jumping to that? I mean, maybe she will be. I doubt it. But
yeah, it's a bit of a stretch. I mean, yeah, they're definitely, you know, like having her dating a loser with like a nice red car. It's just like Shelley, like, you know, marrying Leo. So yeah, it's not like, you know, one would assume that Shelley would be a little bit just like, hey, you know, that didn't work out so well. Like, you know, stop being an idiot and not give her money. But,
right,
you know, people are weak. They do whatever. But yeah, you know, it was just nice to see Shelley and Norma and, you know, Mike Nelson.
The Mike Nelson moment that was with the shitty boyfriend. I was like, oh, look what he's become. Oh, he's become a tool. Okay. Well, that's about right.
It's funny because I'm watching 6 Feet Under too, and he kind of like he dresses like the character he plays on that show. So I'm just like, oh, you know, same guy. This is funny.
That's right. He's the competitor. That's right. Actually, I think I know him better from 6 Feet Under than I do. than I even remembered him being on Twin Peaks. Now that you mentioned it, I feel like there's one thing. Oh God, the scene with Truman and his wife. I mean, I'll give it to. What's his favorite? I mean, I do like watching Robert Forster just being so deadpan and patient during that whole scene, but oh my God, that's a painful scene to watch because she's just, it's just the annoyance level and it doesn't stop. And I know it's guest cast. I know it's Candy Clark. I know that means something to some people out there. I know who she is. I don't care. Oh my God, that scene just went on forever and I wanted to kill somebody. You're like, oh, then I have to stare at the bucket? What, now I have to buy a bigger bucket? I mean, And I got a little frustrated when we flash, so to speak, to, like, Hawk, you know, going through all the evidence. So and I love, like, Andy with his weird, goofy hair. I don't even understand that hair, quite frankly, at this point. And how he's going over everything so meticulous, and I started thinking, oh, they're showing that Andy's not a moron after all. Maybe we kind of were mistaken in those first 4 episodes. And then that whole scene is there just for like, oh, I'm not finding anything about Indians here. Like, oh, Jesus. Anyway, I mean, I'm still with the show. It's not like I didn't hate the episode. I just didn't like it as much as the first four. I'm sure there will be better ones upcoming. I just need them to get to the Dougie stuff faster to get to, you know, Cooper and other stuff. Or just give me other storylines for me to really hook into that, have some sort of forward momentum. And then you can throw in the quirky, weird, just there, just to be strange stuff. I don't mind that. I just felt there was more of that than there was anything that really gave me a purpose to watching this episode, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, more style over substance. I can see that.
Yeah.
And you're allergic to it, right? Obviously, you're hacking.
I would, if you're going to do something like this, an episode like this, then you know what? At least reserve at least 7 to 10 minutes of it for some Black Lodge stuff, and then I'll be fine. Because I can watch crazy shit in the Black Lodge all live long day.
Yeah.
I can, you want to do that, you can have as many Dr. Jacoby scenes as you want. I don't care. And look, we got a mystery solved. Now we know what the golden shovels are about. So that's pretty cool.
If we're shoveling that shit.
Exactly. All right, so since I don't know how many times I coughed on this podcast, I apologize for that. I tried to hit mute a couple of times, but I'm always afraid when I try to hit the mute button, I'm going to hit the disconnect button, so that's why I don't do it.
I did that at work today. I was in. I'm not going to explain the whole circumstances, but I had to call our waste management company to try to get some better dumpsters than what we have. I was on hold for a while, and then I got talked to somebody. Then I got transferred and was on hold for a while again. And then then she had to put me on hold for a minute just so she could try to figure something out. And I muted it because I was eating ice cream cake. And then when I heard her voice come back, I'm just like, I had the phone muted. I'm just like, oh, hold on a second. And I fucking pushed the button to hang up. And I was never able to get in touch with her again. It's fucking dumbass shit.
Yeah, I've had the experience of being when those kind of things where you have to be on hold for literally a half an hour to 40 minutes before you can actually talk to someone. But it seems to be some governmental thing. I can't remember what it was. It might have been me trying to get through the unemployment once or something with health insurance or something. Yeah. And then
both those are notoriously terrible.
And then I accidentally got disconnected. And I was like, no! Not to be confused with hello. All right, let's wrap this sucker up.
Yep.
So if you found it in your heart to enjoy this podcast, hopefully you would enjoy hanging out on our Facebook page as well. It's the Serious TV Drama Podcast page. Find the page that way. Which way? I don't know what I'm saying anymore. Like the page and join the conversation about shows like Fargo, Twin Peaks, Better Call Saul, and so many others. You can also find us on iTunes the very same way. In iTunes, type in the Serious TV Drama Podcast. You can subscribe to our feed as well as rate and review us there. And finally, you can follow us on Twitter. Our handle there is at STVD Podcast. That's STVD as in Serious TV Drama Podcast. We should be back at some point next week to hopefully go over the next three episodes of each of these three series, provided I am still able to access my close friend's Showtime channel. The whole trying to access it from home thing doesn't work. Doesn't work. It must be some sort of security things to keep Scott out. I don't know. And if anyone out there is a Leftovers fan and you haven't checked it out yet, you would be doing yourself a disservice not to track down our previous podcast where Dan and I got together without any notes whatsoever to discuss the Leftovers finale. And to a certain extent, we sort of talked about the season and the series overall, I would say. But mostly we were talking about the finale.
Yeah, I was a little sleepy and had trouble saying anything at the beginning. I got it together a little bit, and we were able to have a good conversation, cover the show really nicely. I'd also recommend listening to our sister show, Geek Girl Soup. Their coverage of it was good, and they covered a fair amount of things that we didn't get to. So if you feel like burning a couple hours, only half of those wasted listening to the podcast, give their episode and ours a listen. Because Leftovers was a good show and deserves some thoughtful analysis or thoughtless analysis, depending on what was going on in my mind at the time.
Well, I gave it a lot of thought because it's all a lie. Anyway, so With all that said, thanks for listening to us. And Dan, thanks for getting your act together in an earlier fashion than I'm ever used to. How often do we finish a podcast and it's this hour? Never. Never happens.
Yeah.
Not that anyone knows what the clock says in our respective homes right now, because that makes no sense to bring up on the podcast. Anyway.
420 listeners. Woo! Yeah,
sounds like it. You know, whatever John McCain was smoking earlier today. You know.
Yeah, I think, he was smoking a clogged artery, I'm guessing.
I don't understand how the guy who was actually had been, up until now, like the most outspoken critic on that side of the aisle of, you know, the current administration and been most concerned about all these things, seemed to go in reverse. I think the Russians are behind this, quite frankly. I think they did something to him. I think there was like a little dart, like a little spy gun dart thing happened, and now he's under their control.
You know, I liked him a lot in 2000 when he was running against Bush. He like seemed decent. And then after that, he's just been like just a complete fucking tool. So, sorry, John McCain, you know. You had your chance, but you just ended up being a fucking shill like the rest, so blah, blah, blah.
The Palin thing kind of killed it for most people anyway. That was like, wait, what? Because I liked McCain up until that. It's like, wait, Sarah Palin? And he kind of was winning me over again because, you know, what Trump said about, you know, his opinion on POWs not being heroes. I was like, wait, are you kidding me? Which, by the way, in any other year, if a presidential candidate had just said that, they wouldn't have been elected. Just that alone.
Yeah, you'd think all these old fucks that are voting for this douchebag party could, like, you know, like, they're the ones that are like, oh, love the military, oh, look at this flag on my fucking truck. I mean, yeah, there's a Confederate flag on my fucking truck, too, but, you know, you're supposed to, like, you know, they're always, like, you know, worshipping the military, but when push comes to shove, they're fucking hypocrites, just like, you know. The rest of us, yourself and myself included, because we're fucking amazing.
Thank you, whatever it was, 27-29% of the country or voting public who did this. So, way to go, guys. Anyway, that's our one and maybe only, maybe not. Who knows? We'll see how the rest of this year goes. Political commentary, unexpected at the end of our Serious TV Drama podcast.
Well, it'll be our last one, because once Sarah Palin becomes the NSA director and they run this podcast through their fucking database, yeah, we're done for. We'll be fucking black-sided like nobody's business.
Hey, it means I won't have to worry about my rent situation anymore, so that's fine by me. Anyway, on that rather dismal note, I'm going to say good night.
Good night, Scott. We'll be right back.